You know, about one in five adults have a mental illness or experience one every year. And I know this is a difficult topic to deal with, sometimes to talk with family and friends and coworkers, trying to explain it. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest today works to combat negative stereotypes and stigmas about people living with mental health issues. Tally Moses, an associate professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on psychiatric disorders in children, mental health treatment, and the stigma of mental illness. And maybe you've experienced discrimination because of a mental health issue. Have you helped a loved one overcome stereotypes while dealing with a mental illness? Maybe you're working to combat your own biases about mental illness and want to learn some more. We'd love to hear from you, so I hope you'll call in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Dr. Tally Moses, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, I appreciate it. You can maybe start out by defining stigma. We're talking about stigma as it pertains to mental illness for our listeners.
Absolutely. So stigma is an old Greek word, really referring to an attribute or a trait that basically is a blemish of character, a blemish of physicality that renders a person as less than, tainted, discounted, and so forth. And in terms of today's world, when we think of stigma, we think of people's responses to this trait, and we can think of a set of sort of negative attitudes and beliefs that motivate us to fear, reject, avoid, discriminate against those with mental illness or other disabilities.
How have attitudes in this area changed much over time?
There's some research that suggests they have, and one would think intuitively that they have gotten more favorable. And it's sort of a mess because in some ways they have. People understand mental illness better. They're more approving or favorable towards seeking mental health treatment. At the same time, certain aspects of stigma, especially the perception that people with mental illness are dangerous, have actually got those attitudes have increased or have worsened over time. And it's interesting that we've had a sort of public health approach to diminishing mental illness stigma over time that seeks to pair mental illness with biological causes, hereditary, genetic, chemical causes, which aim to basically deblame a person, to diminish the blame or the shame. But what we find is that actually that sort of frame of mental illness as a biological illness in some ways has increased people's desire to avoid others with mental illness. So it's pretty widespread. Mental illness is widespread.
Don in Reedsburg has something for us. Let's just go there. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she actually suffers from PTSD with some manic bipolar and panda syndrome. And what's funny is a lot of people, including teachers, don't seem to understand some of the issues that come with that. A lot of the time we get comments that they think that, like, she's just spoiled or she's a brat and that her issues aren't affecting her as much as they do, but they affect her daily life quite frequently because she has frequent meltdowns or certain things like sense or things that she sees can cause her to get into a panic mode and, or she gets, an attitude because of it, but it has nothing to do with, her being a brat or being spoiled, that these things can severely affect people in ways that people wouldn't even suspect them to.
Yeah. Yeah. A comment on that, Dr. Tally Moses?
Absolutely. So thanks for calling. This is what you speak of is so common. kids and their troubles and travails in schools, and how important it is for teachers and the student services teams to really appreciate and be flexible and provide support over time. And it's difficult because, you know, from the perspective of teachers, it's difficult to negotiate and balance out the needs of the student versus the immediate exigencies of a situation in class. But that's very common. I hear about that a lot. My research focuses primarily on adolescents and children, and the school setting is so important. And I hope, you know, I have a sense that you're a very good advocate for your daughter.
I am. I'm a very good advocate, and we try to get her teachers as much information as possible, and we've actually got her so that she has like a sensory room that if she needs to leave class, she can go to get help or to calm down. So
that's great. And, you know, schools and specific teachers will vary greatly in terms of how willing and able they are to work with parents and with children in this way. So that sounds like a pretty good setup, generally speaking.
Yeah. And I imagine just that education, I mean, this puts a lot on the parents in a situation like this, I would think.
Parents.
Go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
It does. It puts a lot of stress on us because then, you know, we've got to find ways that she can learn that help her deal with normal day stress or normal day situations. And, you know, if she has a breakdown in class and she gets embarrassed and she thinks people are looking down on her or her friend thinks that she's weird. And, you know, she's got a pretty good group of peers that, you know, are her friends that, you know, help her, you know, realize that they're there for her too and that they understand what she's going through, which, you know, helps her through her school days.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought up the parent issues because a mental illness in a child absolutely creates a whole intricate array of issues for families to deal with. And some families are more capable and have more resources at their disposal, including time. We find that parents of children with a mental disorder, you know, especially single parents, are at real peril in terms of, you know, their job status. They're often called out from work to come help or to save a situation. And parents, too, are subject to stigma at times. You know, I don't know if you've had that experience, but parents, you know, families sometimes find that friends stop inviting, stop calling, you know, give advice when it's unwanted, and various other subtle ways of sort of expressing disenchantment, I suppose, with the family.
Yeah.
It does happen quite a bit, you know, where friends tell us that we need to, you know, spank her or put her in her place, or family that don't understand the situation will tell us that, you know, you need to put her in check. She shouldn't be talking to people like that or acting like that. And it can be depressing at home, you know, and she's got me and her mom, you know, and her mom deals with anxiety, so when she's got to deal with it, she gets anxious, and then I've got to step in and kind of help, you know, calm down situations and help both people calm down. And, you know, we tell people that we don't do that, that there's other ways to help her get out of her meltdowns. Like sometimes she needs to be left alone, or sometimes she needs something to keep her preoccupied so she's not thinking about the negative things that are going on. And, you know, it does take a lot of stress. And it's a good thing I have a job that lets me have FMLA, so if I need to leave to go get her out of school, I can be there for her.
Yeah. Sounds like she's lucky to have a father and probably a mom, too, like you, Don.
Yes.
Thank you very much for calling. That really is almost the crux of, I'm sure you get this all the time from other families undergoing the same thing.
Absolutely. So the predicament of families, especially mothers, but, you know, parents in general, is pretty tough, because even when you have well-meaning, well-intentioned efforts to try to help the family, or parents often receive messages that their parenting is somehow to be at fault for the child's mental illness, and You know, it really does taint an entire, it can taint an entire family. Of course, it depends on the nature of the child's condition, how visible, how prominent, and that sort of thing. But families have to not only deal with the child and the pain of having, of seeing their child struggle, not only with the symptoms of the mental illness, but on top of that, with the pain, the self-image issues, and the social issues associated with the mental, the mental illness, but also just this added layer of stigma, and parents feel that very prominently, and then they have their own, you know, they have to have a defensive posture a lot of time, you know, with vis-a-vis the world, which seeks to basically label and categorize and understand things, but often in the process tends to label families and parents as well.
Yeah. And I can, you know, you mentioned single family households, and I expect that this can result in lots of issues between husband and wife.
Oh, absolutely. There is research on mental illness in the family, when children have mental illness, it's more especially externalizing problems, which relate to sort of behavioral, disruptive behavior and so forth, that, you know, there's more divorce in those families, there's more general friction in those families. By the time we see them in treatment, they are, you know, there's a lot of water under that bridge and a lot to sort of address.
Yeah, I would think so. We're talking today with Dr. Tally Moses. She is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on psychiatric disorders in children, mental health treatment, and the stigma of mental illness. And we're dealing with those things today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we'll be back with our guest. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about mental illness and stereotypes associated with people with mental illness, learning a bit about stigmas and how stigmas negatively impact those living with mental health issues. My guest today, Dr. Tally Moses, associate professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on psychiatric disorders in children, mental health treatment, and the stigma of mental illness. Maybe you have some stereotypes or maybe some questions about combating biases. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Brad in Waukesha up next with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Brad. What's on your mind?
Well, basically, it comes out like this. I moved to Arizona in 2009, probably just before the height of the recession, at least out there. And one of the things is Arizona is a very, it's a very Republican conservative state. And one of my problems with that was basically, I'm from Chicago, and it's a fairly liberal place and very accepting of, for the most part, of people with what I term differences, being different, stuff like that, whether that be LGBTQ, just weird people, stuff like that. Big cities will be like that. But being out there after a couple of years, I began to feel... I'm kind of more of a feeling person. Maybe you can detect that in what I'm speaking of. But I began to feel as very much as an outsider. And in fact, at one point, because I kind of demanded to be treated fairly, I was called a rebel by one of the locals. And I said, you know, to him, imagine that. Northerner being called a rebel in a southern state. So, I mean, I'm kind of confrontative when people question the person I want to be and the freedom I have to be that person. I mean, I'm straight. I'm a white male. I'm 60 now. I was in my 50s then. But it's kind of a depression because I realized, you know, I just did not belong. And I don't know how much of people... with the tribalization of, like, America going on?
Well, let's talk about that. Here's moving to a different area, different kinds of attitudes and maybe stigmas in a way associated with that?
There's definitely some impact that the environment has on the experiences of people with mental illness. So, you know, how accepting, how diverse an environment is, the sort of attitudes in an environment and climate around success and whether, you know, you, and perfectionism, all that, you know, and how, you know, deterministic people feel about success and whether there are other opportunities to make up when you don't have success. All those kinds of environmental components will have an effect on how people experience mental illness. And you say, Brad, that, you know, you experience things being very conservative and which suggests that, you know, in some ways, attitudes around blame and you know, personal responsibility for success have something to do with the stigma that you might have experienced. It's cool that you sort of spoke up for yourself. Sort of one of the things we see in some people that experiences stigmatization is that they sort of are angry and rebellious, was the word you used. And that is not a bad thing. It's certainly good to stand up for yourself, but it takes a toll, too, for people that have to do that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, it does. Thanks for calling, Brad. Appreciate it. Lydia in Manitowoc, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was at the behavioral health clinic here, and I was waiting to get check-in for my appointment, and there was a woman ahead of me who was very agitated, talking loud, obviously upset, and not screaming or anything, but loud. And when she went into the to sit down in the waiting room, I heard the women talking about her and how she shouldn't be acting like that. And what I did was I actually went to someone at the clinic and I explained to them that when you have an anxiety disorder, which I saw myself at times in her, I was able to go and explain that if she could have acted differently, she would have. What mental illness does to me, the way I've learned to explain it to myself and other people, is that it takes away our self-will. Meaning you cannot be in society like other people would want you to simply because you can't. And I explained to her that if anyone should be understanding and trying to help instead of telling her she shouldn't be acting that way, it should be someone in the mental health field, even if it is just the receptionist.
Yeah.
Oh, Lydia, I'm so glad you brought that up. And what a good Samaritan and citizen you are to come and educate the staff there. I'm sure that was a little disconcerting on your part. But I'm so glad you brought this up because when I have interviewed people who have a mental illness, it's been very disheartening for me to learn that some of the most stigmatizing experiences are in the context of mental health treatment and the providers who in subtle and various ways give a sense that the person is inherently different from everybody else or from oneself, that, you know, so the things can be really the way mental health providers can sometimes fail to acknowledge the strengths and capacities of the person or avoid the person somehow or talk down to them in certain ways. So I'm really glad you brought that up because this is something that, you know, as an educator in the School of Social Work, I work hard with students to try to bring up their awareness around their own potential for stigmatization and what they must do to address that.
Yeah. Are there different levels or different types of stigmas? There are, I believe.
Yeah, there really are. So generally, the way we think about stigma is either in public stigma, in terms of public stigma, and in terms of self-stigma. And well, I'd love to talk a little bit about each. So public stigma is what we've been talking about, which is the various ways in which people are devalued and discriminated against by others. And those that sort of stigma process has two levels. One level is at the individual level, which is targeting individuals with overt practices of, you know, social avoidance or harassment, or just most of the time it comes down to, avoidance and rejection and disenfranchisement. Family and friends can also be, we've already talked a little bit about that, but family and friends can also be at the receiving end of individual stigma because of their association with the person with mental illness. So that's at the public stigma at the individual level. Then there's structural stigma, which is much harder to address, but is very prominent. And these are basically institutional and political practices and policies that work to disadvantage a certain stigmatized group, like people with mental illness. And you'll see that as come into play in terms of barriers to quality education or educational attainment, certainly in terms of work and work opportunities, housing, disproportionate, passing toward the juvenile justice or the criminal justice system, less even things like less money for research on mental illness. So that's public stigma, the practices against people with mental illness on either individual or structural levels. You know, we haven't talked so much yet about self-stigma, which in my research with adolescents especially, I have found that to be the most damaging, really, and the most common, which is basically we all grow up socialized in a society with certain, values and norms, mm-hmm. and we understand these. And people internalize these. And when values and attitudes about mental illness become personally relevant, some people internalize those negative stereotypes and apply them toward themselves such that they feel less competent, helpless, inferior in various ways, a lot of self-blaming and self-shaming. So that's a self-stigma sort of process.
I'm going to go to Mike in Woodruff, who has something relating to children, I believe. Mike, thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question regarding my son. He's only 3 years old, so it's kind of, I think, early to look at mental illness, but he kind of has episodes where he gets, very upset and trying to calm him down between his mother and I. He can't console him. He's running around screaming and crying. At what point or at what age do you kind of start to look at it more from a mental health aspect or start to pursue some of those things for kind of early treatment?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's a really good question, and I don't have a clear answer for you. And I'll say that different families will have different sort of thresholds at which they say, okay, this is getting to be something really worrisome, and we need to get some clinical attention for it. With children, Mike, it is really tough to draw that line between normal, temperamental difficulties and, ups and downs and a little bit of delay in development of coping skills that many children experience, and between that and something that looks to be like a more of a sustained condition that needs some treatment. In reality, we see a kind of a worrisome trend, in my opinion, of more toddlers and even children as young as 2 years old being treated with psychotropic medication in this country. That's been sort of an increasing trend. So there are some families that will go there. And, I'm not passing judgment. There may be very good reasons. It's just a little something that we have to be a little bit worried about. The answer to your question is it's up to you, really. And there's nothing necessarily problematic about seeking out some consultation around your son's issues. They might work with you on parenting and on setting sort of more predictability and scheduling. And not to say that this is any of your fault in any way. It's just that sometimes those kinds of approaches help kids, it might just be something that will wane over time, you know, and nothing but time will tell that difference. So I don't have a good answer for you, but if it's something that concerns you and your wife a great deal, I wouldn't hesitate to seek out some consultation.
And who do you go to for that sort of, do you go to your primary physician for a referral, or what do you do?
Yeah, well, primary care physicians in this country are the primary providers of psychotropic medication, if that's the route you are interested in. And I'm hoping that that's not the route you would go to immediately, but depending on your insurance, most managed care institutions have a behavioral health component. You often do not need a referral from a primary care doctor, but you might. It depends on your insurance policy. There's depending on your resources, there's always private practice oriented clinicians in the neighborhood. In every locale, there is a mental health center, and here in Dane County, we have the Journey Mental Health Center as an example. Sometimes the wait lists are pretty daunting. So it really depends on where you are, what insurance you have, and
But if you're sort of up to the parents to decide.
Yes.
And I'm kind of with you on the medication side, or avoiding that if it's possible.
Well, with such a young child, it's ideal to try to avoid that. Of course, again, not passing judgment. There's different cases, different recommendations. But yeah, you it's not your first, it shouldn't be your first go-to.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Mike, and thank you so much for calling. I hope that helped. Nikki and Fond du Lac will give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Kind of dealing with a little anxiety at the moment talking about this, because this is the first time that I've actually tried to speak out and reach out for a resource or for help. But I am 25 years old now, and I wasn't officially diagnosed with my bipolar disorder, depression, and anxiety until I was about 18, 19. So I had been dealing with it since I was about 10 or 11. And I know one stereotype that I had grown up with in the minority culture was that, you know, Black people don't have mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. And completely found that to be false. And I feel like that was a stereotype that had stuck with my mother, because even trying, when I was younger, having issues in school and trying to explain to her how I felt then and even now, it seemed like it was always in denial. And ever since then, I feel like I have had issues in any type of relationship, whether it was, you know, with the opposite sex or just with trying to form friendships with other, you know, girls to hang out with. It was always hard for me. Just this past year, 2017, was probably one of the hardest years. Because I felt like I had lost so many people. One of my strongest holds was my grandmother. She was the one person that I actually could talk to, and it seemed like she actually cared. But it seems like when it came to any friends that I had, I could try to explain it to them, but nobody seemed to get it. And I was always told, you know, it'll get better, or just suck it up, or, you know, something else that, you know, dealing with a mental illness, it doesn't help to hear.
No.
Because a lot of people don't know what we're going through, and it's hard for us to explain in a way that other people understand and really take it into heart to actually be there and be genuine and trying to get help and help us to, I guess, just kind of get through what we're going through at the moment. I'll take my comment off air.
Well, Nikki, I hope you're getting some help in this area, let's put it this way, is there help available for her? And Nikki certainly isn't the only one. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
I want to put my arm around you right now, Nikki.
Nikki, I commend you for, you know, you were nervous, you called and you spoke your truth, and you did so in a very articulate, genuine way. So there's some things are happening that are positive. And I'm hoping that, just like Larry said, that you are getting some treatment. You're right. I mean, from my experience and certainly from the perspective of some research studies, that it is harder to overcome some of the community stigmas around mental illness and acceptance of mental illness in sort of the African-American community in some ways, just because there seems to be a desire to avoid this issue and to minimize it when it comes to families. And just like you said, suck it up and it'll get better. This is an invisible condition, right? So people can't see. People can't really truly know how you feel. So they, you know, they're trying to, but they get impatient and they get, you know, they get, so different communities have different ways of handling on a general level. And it sounds like you really had to struggle on both fronts, both with the condition and the symptoms and the anxiety itself and the depression and with people's attitudes and toward that.
Is there, I'm not sure, Nikki hung up on us, hung up, but are there places or things that she should do or folks in her situation should be doing for getting additional help? Again, where do we go?
That's a really good question. So there are online chat, you know, groups, and certainly there's support groups in various locales. I don't know about Fond du Lac, which is where Nikki comes from. What she did by calling the radio is something she hopefully can do a little bit more of, which is reach out and try to find niches that will feel accepting and supportive. Of course, when you're living in a smaller town, it's more difficult. If she were in a large sort of city where there's a lot of those kinds of things happening, it'd be easier to find a niche like that.
Where would you go online to look for something like that?
Oh, gosh. I'm not a big social media person, so you've got me there. I'll tell you that there may be, so we have some possibilities in Wisconsin. We have some stigma busting organizations, so to speak, in Wisconsin. There is, for example, that she could maybe get some information from and kind of touch base with other like-minded people. And it's called WISE, Ending Stigma Together. And it's, she can look up WISE, WISE. And Google that. There's definitely other websites that she can go to and make contact, and maybe they can provide leads. And like, for example, No Shame on You with a U, as a website that, you know, that she could look into. There's Erasing the Distance is another. I suppose one thing you could do is just literally Google support. Mental health and the Fond du Lac or another area that you can make your way to.
Makes good sense to me. And I wish we had more time here, but we've run almost completely out of time. It's a task that obviously we haven't had the opportunity to cover fully, so I guess we're going to have you back and talk some more about this. But one good site, if you're going to have relating to this, you got one good one, what would it be?
One good site?
Mm-hmm.
Website, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would definitely try to look at the National Mental Health Awareness Campaign, www.nostigma.org. Or the SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They have all kinds of resources available.
Dr. Tally Moses, thank you so much for being with us today. The time really flew by, and all our lines are filled. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody. We'll try to do this again. Dr. Tally Moses, Associate Professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on psychiatric disorders in children, mental health treatment, and the stigma of mental illness. And thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.